This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Wait, was there a football game yesterday? Me? I was watching to see what the best businesswoman in the country had in store for us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 8th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. While candidates and political reporters of all stripes run around New Hampshire for another 24 hours or so, and don't worry, we'll get to Beyonce in a second, but a word here as we begin about one of the big prizes those politicians are chasing, the destiny, the fate of the American economy. It's been rough, as you know, 2016 for that economy so far. Uncertainty, sluggish growth, volatility in the extreme in markets of virtually every kind. There was more volatility today, too, but I digress. We'll get to that later. Campaigns and the people who run them can go big. They can buy lots of television airtime to try to win this thing. Or they can go small, good old-fashioned door-to-door retail politics in what's called the ground game in those early states. And getting that right can make all the difference, as Marketplace's Bree Benishore reports.
If you're running for president and you're looking at your war chest, you have to make constant decisions about how to divvy up your time and your money. You can focus on, say, rallies.
We're going to take back our country from these incompetent politicians.
Or TV ads.
I'm Marco Rubio. I approve this message because this is about the greatest country in the world.
But research shows the real bang for your buck comes from the ground game.
Phone calls, organized door knocking, volunteer recruitment, driving people to the polls on election day who need it, that sort of thing.
Joshua Dart teaches political communication at Louisiana State.
It takes about $670,000 in ad buys in a general election to get the same number of estimated votes as it would by opening a field office, which is about $21,000.
So it's both cheaper and more effective to round up boots on the ground, and yet a number of candidates haven't focused on it, at least not yet.
Both Clinton and Sanders had over 20 field offices in Iowa. The Republicans, I don't think any campaign had more than five.
Trump's performance in Iowa has widely been blamed on his lack of volunteer organizing. Seth Maskett is at the University of Denver.
It is something that a lot of candidates, particularly those who are somewhat new to presidential campaigns, don't always take very seriously.
At the same time, networks of lawn-trotting volunteers aren't something you can just whip up overnight. And the people who build these networks are not a dime a dozen. Sherry Jacobus is a Republican strategist.
There's also a limited number of people to invest in. And in a very large, crowded Republican field, everybody's trying to get those people.
But the field is narrowing, and those networks will consolidate. The lesson of the ground game isn't a hard one to learn, but you don't get to the general without learning it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The numbers are in for the Super Bowl. Nielsen says the game and all the trappings reached an average of nearly 112 million people last night. That's a lot, but down, actually, just a hair from the past couple of years. Here's the telltale line item, though. I love this one. 115.5 million people, that is more, were watching during the half hour from 8:30 to 9 East Coast time, or, in other words, during the halftime show. And you know what? They weren't there for Coldplay, man. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains how this weekend was just the latest example of the business of Beyonce.
Here's the timeline. Saturday, Beyonce releases a new song, Free, exclusively on her husband Jay-Z's streaming service, Tidal. On Sunday, she performs said single at the Super Bowl and announces a world tour. David Bakula is a VP at Nielsen Music.
The ability to just say, hey, you know what? 36 hours ago, you had no idea what was coming. And now look at this. By the way, here's the song. By the way, here's the tour.
Longtime music exec Johnny Walker says this is just the latest example of Beyonce's skill as a marketer.
She's able to sell not only music, but, you know, she can sell cosmetics. She sells soda. She sells whatever. And I think she also understands that she is the product.
Walker says Beyonce knows her core demographic and gives them exactly what they want. And her superstar power allows her to tightly control her messaging.
Okay, ladies, now let's get information.
In a social media age, she can keep new songs, even entire albums, secret until they are deployed for maximum effect. Serona Elton is chair of the Music, Media, and Industry Department at the University of Miami. She says no one wants to cross the queen bee.
Not only would you be looking at some legal troubles, but your reputation would be seriously damaged and absolutely could affect the rest of your career.
Which probably wouldn't be as long as Beyonce's. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, about Wall Street then, just because I promised I would, not necessarily because I want to. Today, it was bad, very bad. Could have been worse, and in fact, it was during the session. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Faithful listeners to this program will know that we've been doing a regular series with Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, and his wife, Deb, the past couple of years. They fly around the United States in their own small plane. We go along from time to time, pulling together what we learn into a project called American Futures. Jim's got the cover story in the March edition of the magazine about the key lessons small cities and towns in this country have to teach us. Jim, it's good to have you back.
Kai, thank you.
It has been 3 years that you and Deb have been flying around this country. Give me the thumbnail statistical sketch. How many cities do you think?
We've stopped in about 50 cities at least overnight. There's about two dozen of them where we've gone back repeatedly, usually for about 2 weeks. And there's quite a few where we've met up with you and your team.
Yeah, that's right. You start, though, in San Bernardino with obviously what happened there a couple of months ago and how it resonated with you. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so the places we've been, San Bernardino, which is right next door to the place where I grew up in Redlands, California, is one that really stuck with us because objectively, it's about as difficult a situation as any city in the country. Economically, all their bases of sustenance have been removed in the last 10 or 15 years. And politically, it has a kind of unique logjam that has put the city into bankruptcy. And so we had spent over this past year a lot of time in San Bernardino talking about people who had some idea about whether there was any hope for the place.
And it literally was people deciding they were going to have meetings on civic affairs.
There's this wonderful group called Generation Now. It's a group of people very diverse in race. You know, San Bernardino is a majority-minority city and mainly in their 20s and early 30s who decided a couple of years ago that they were just sick and tired of being described as the losers of California and the losers of America and the losers of their generation. So they decided that they would try to figure out what it took to make a city work. And so they're registering people to vote. They're restoring parks. They're painting murals on abandoned buildings, picking up things around town, just trying to set an example of the city they'd like to see. Obviously, by itself, that doesn't bring jobs to a community. But it was impressive to us that they had put so much of their own effort into turning around a place they loved and wanted to make viable again.
I want you to tell me about Duluth, Minnesota, what you found there and then the bigger picture.
Duluth is a city I love. I first went there almost 20 years ago because the kind of airplane I fly, a Cirrus SR-22, is made there. It's a city that has gone from grandeur a century ago when it was one of the richest cities in the United States with timber and grain and ore from the Mesabi Range and all the rest there to complete collapse of all those old economy foundations. And now you have a number of people who've decided that they want to remake a high-tech and aerospace and medical tech and outdoors recreation economy there in Duluth. And so people have moved there to try to make it the hip city of the North. And indeed, it won Outside Magazine's poll as best city last year.
It also leads to this great phrase in this piece. You know, we think of technology in this country as like Silicon Valley and Boston and maybe outside Washington, and that's pretty much it. You characterize it, though, as an archipelago of technology centers, which I thought was great.
Yes, and what we discovered and meant to convey is how we know about the concentrations of talent and economic might in the big coastal cities. What most people don't know is how much more is going on in Duluth and in Columbus, Ohio, and in Fresno, and in Greenville, South Carolina, and Burlington, Vermont. So you have the sense not of a nation that's just emptying out towards the coast, but that has its strong coastal citadels, but then whose entire fabric is also full of people trying to reinvent in their own local circumstances, new industries, new lives.
All right, so let me get to the title of this piece then, How America is Putting Itself Back Together. On the cover, it's actually a question, can America put itself back together again? You talk about that in the last couple of paragraphs of this piece, in which you say, in essence, we need the national discussion to focus like the local discussion has.
I think anybody would admit or agree that this is a time of real trouble at national level politics and national level discourse in the United States. The parties don't agree on anything. Whatever you stand for nationally, you're likely to feel disappointed. At the same time, a lot of the places we saw, most of the places we saw, had figured out ways to engineer practical solutions to their disagreements and invest in their future and find ways to reinvent their schools, to teach people new skills and do all the other things we wish the country could do. It would be better if this were an era in our national politics where we could do that on some sort of national scale, but for various reasons that seems not feasible. So as a second best option, at least we have a counter-narrative of parts of America that are functioning and are finding ways to put their own regions back together.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He and his wife, Deb, and us every now and then have been out on the road for the past couple of years. Jim, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
The next time somebody tells you public policy is just for policy wonks, send them a link to this next story to set them straight. There was record flooding in Missouri around New Year, especially in and around St. Louis. Floodwaters caused hundreds of millions of dollars in damage to both homes and businesses. St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum has this story now on public policy decisions and what they mean for regular people.
On a particularly chilly afternoon before New Year's Day, residents of Pacific, Missouri got in their cars and drove to a hilltop park. What they saw was startling. Floodwaters from the Merrimack River submerged a big chunk of the city's residential neighborhoods and an even larger swath of the business district. About 7,000 people live in Pacific, and from this vantage point, residents saw floodwaters overtake scores of homes, restaurants, and a historic opera house that's now an event center. Carolyn Davis has lived in Pacific for a long time.
It breaks your heart a little bit. So, you know, you're looking at landmarks that have never been under, you know, the Opera House, our florist shop that's been there forever, you know, restaurants and families and people. It's just crazy.
The flood swept through St. Louis and Franklin counties after heavy rains, leaving some to chalk up the natural disaster to an act of God. But Bob Criss, a professor of earth sciences at Washington University in St. Louis, says people shouldn't escape responsibility.
I do not believe this has got to be a perfect world for us to not be stupid. These are floodplain areas. They are well mapped. People realize the risk of these areas.
Criss has studied flooding in the St. Louis area for years. He's critical of how some communities erected levees, artificial embankments aimed at stopping a river from overflowing. Criss contends these structures mess up how rivers flow. They may block water from flowing into one community only to be pushed into another. And Chris says cities behind levees converted floodplains into large residential and retail developments.
We just have to avoid putting more buildings in harm's way.
Those buildings took away grassy fields to soak up water. Chris says this leads to more destructive flooding.
There is nothing mysterious about what's going on. It only mystifies people that have a peculiar point of view.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon says the recent flooding had nothing to do with dikes, dams, or levees.
It happened because of a unique weather pattern, dropped over 10 inches of rain in a short period of time in hill country with thin soil. And when that happens, you're going to have floods.
Still, some government officials say there are lessons here. John Posey is the director of research for East-West Gateway. It manages big projects throughout the St. Louis region. He says it is possible to protect existing development and prevent future flooding.
When you have an area that's already populated, a place, like a historic downtown or a place with a lot of businesses, it's really difficult for me to try to second-guess that decision. What I think is important is to hang on to the floodplain that we've got.
One way to do that is to take advantage of federal programs that move places and people off floodplains. Republican Congressman Rodney Davis says that happened a lot in his home district in Illinois, just across the border from Missouri, and it paid dividends.
Illinois has taken advantage of moving these structures out of the watershed, and we have then less damages, less structural damages on the Illinois side than I believe you do on the Missouri side.
St. Louis residents are still picking up the pieces from the flood and frigid temperatures. But if they decide to move to higher ground, it could provide more space for floodwaters to go and a little more breathing room for residents of Missouri's river cities. In St. Louis, I'm Jason Rosenbaum for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When I first saw the house, I looked through. All right, this mine. I want it. Write the papers.
When owning a home is more than just owning a home. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Dow off 177 points today, 1.1% closed at 16,027. The NASDAQ gave back 79 points, 1.8%, 4,283. The S&P 500 down 26 points, 1.4%, ended things at 18.53. The Dow at 1 point today at the low, off 401.3%. Tough day all around, in particular, though, for financial shares. Morgan Stanley off nearly 7%. Bank of America, Visa, Citigroup all gave back more than 5% today. Investors got bearish on home builders after analysts at Credit Suisse suggested tough times were ahead in that sector. Toll Brothers and D.R. Horton both tumbled around 4%. Gold hit its highest level since back in October, and miners saw a bump. Anglo Gold Ashanti Limited, ticker symbol AU for you periodic table nerds out there, gained 1.5%. A percent and a half is another way to say that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are in the middle of a busy, busy time here in the entertainment capital of the world, Hollywood, that is. It's pilot season, that time of year when broadcast networks start actually spending money to help them figure out what we are going to see on TV next fall. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is here to make me smart. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
All right. For the somewhat uninformed among us, like me,
exactly how does pilot season work?
All right, we're talking about the broadcast networks here. But roughly, in the fall, a bunch of writers come in and pitch them ideas. They listen to all those pitches. They pick a bunch of ideas. They hire the writers to go write those scripts. The scripts come in right around Christmas time. The networks then sit down and they read and read and read. They offer notes. They go back and forth with the writers. And then they pick which of those scripts they're actually going to shoot pilots of, which are sort of the test run for the fall season. So from those pilots, we're going to get next year's television, or this year, later this year, this year's television shows. Yeah.
How many? I mean, how many pilots do they shoot? How many? I mean, what's the math?
It depends completely on the hole the network's trying to fill. So Fox is looking at a world without American Idol. It's buying a lot of pilots this year because it's got to fill that time. ABC has also picked up a lot of shows, comedies and dramas, to try to fill holes. NBC has fewer holes, so it buys fewer pilots. But these are really big bets these networks are making. Film LA estimates that the average comedy pilot costs about $2 million to shoot, and a drama pilot's more in the neighborhood of $6 to $9 million for one show. Yeah. So they're investing a lot of money in these picks they're making right now.
So what are they picking? Because I didn't know they were that
expensive. It's a lot of money.
Wow. So seriously, what are they picking?
Well, so look, they've got to come up with something that is going to please advertisers and appeal to a wide group of people, but also something we're going to want to watch in this super competitive landscape. So they think time travel is an answer.
Seriously?
There are a couple of time travel shows out there, but the networks are also trying to find the next big soapy drama like Empire. I mean, Empire's been so successful for Fox. Everyone's looking for that. You've got the big names, the names you know, and then just the bread and butter, the procedurals and those family comedies. Because who doesn't love a good family comedy?
Then what happens? So they've picked all these things, and I guess they're going to screen the pilots, or what do they do?
So now they got to shoot them. It is scramble time, sort of across Hollywood right now, because they've got to cast these pilots. They've got to get all the crew that's going to go behind the scenes. So they've got to come up with the cameramen, the editors, the locations. I mean, the people who are going to feed these.
The craft services people.
So they've got to get all of that done in a short period of time. Then they look at these pilots. Then they start making those decisions about what's actually going to be in their lineup for the fall and what's going in the dustbin.
Couple of quick follow-ups. They do sometimes skip pilots and go straight to full series pickups, right?
Yeah, so that's interesting. And that's happening more and more often right now because the television landscape is so competitive.
Right.
So if you've got an idea or a person that you really believe in, more and more often you're seeing these networks just say, we're going straight to series because we trust this. And if we don't do it, somebody else is going to.
Right. This whole idea, following on to Netflix and Amazon and binge watching and all that, this whole idea of television seasons with the networks, when are they going to get over that, right?
I would say the networks are experimenting with that. They've dipped their toes into the water, but it's such a different model for them that they've really got to figure out how and if it could work. And it's not clear that it has.
Adrian Hill on the Entertainment Desk. Thanks.
Thank you.
As I mentioned up at the top of the program, the New Hampshire primary is tomorrow. And once the polls close, candidates and their entourages will be hustling to the next states on the election year calendar, Nevada and South Carolina. Allendale County is the poorest county in South Carolina. The census says about 30% of people there live below the poverty line. Last year, the Obama administration named Allendale County a promise zone, along with five other counties in rural and South Carolina, which means the region gets first crack at federal grants and loan packages aimed at reducing poverty. Caitlin Esch from our Wealth and Poverty team took a trip down to South Carolina to see what that might mean in practice.
Driving through Allendale County, forests and cotton fields give way to a small town also called Allendale, with abandoned motels and vacant storefronts reminiscent of better days. Wilbur Cave is showing me around.
My 102-year-old mother is a patient here at the Mercy Home.
Cave is with a nonprofit affordable housing development organization called Allendale County Alive. He says Allendale used to market itself as the halfway point between the Northeast and Florida, so snowbirds heading south would stop on the way down.
And when they came back through, they would stop and finish their trip. Somebody had a real great marketing idea. And, mileage, it is almost about midpoint.
But a highway completed in the 1970s bypassed the town and gutted the tourism industry. Then in the 1990s, the Savannah River site, a nearby nuclear reservation, downsized and laid off thousands of workers. Now a third of all residents live in poverty. K Cave hopes the Promise Zone will allow Allendale County Alive to expand and do more of the work it's already doing in the rural South, develop affordable housing for very low-income renters, and help people build wealth through home ownership. Which brings us to the door of someone Cave has known since childhood. 63-year-old great-grandmother and former construction worker Alfreda Scott.
Everybody calls me Frida.
About a year ago, Cave's organization helped Scott do something she never thought she'd be able to do, buy her own home. Scott paid $60,000 for a tidy brick home in unincorporated Allendale County.
When I first saw the house, I looked through it. All right, this man, I want it. Write the papers.
There's a room for visiting grandchildren, big walk-in closets. Best of all, it's quiet.
My neighbors, while I know them, they know me. We don't be up in each other's door. So if I want to play my music, well, then I won't have nobody banging on the wall telling me I'm too loud.
Of course, it wasn't easy. Scott is disabled and lives off a fixed income. She had to learn to save money and improve her credit score.
They had home buyer school, the first home buyer's class they had. Well, I ain't got nothing else to do. I'm going to go and see what this is about.
Allendale County Alive worked with Scott for 3 years and helped her qualify for a special USDA rural development loan. It offers 100% financing and a 33-year repayment period.
It did go through some years, and at times I got sort of, I was ready to pull out my hair, give up on it, say later for it. I think I turned on Mr. Cave over there pretty great, too.
But it's cases like Alfreda Scott's that Wilbur Cave is desperate to see more of. Driving down a rutted rural street past dilapidated mobile homes, Cave points to the houses that his organization has built.
Sometimes the pace of progress is so slow that you can easily become discouraged. But you just have to be optimistic, because if you're not, it's going to be very difficult to convince that family who's never owned a home that they can become homeowners.
Cave admits Allendale County Alive has barely managed to survive over the years. Now he's hoping the new 10-year Promise Zone will allow the organization to acquire 50 more affordable housing rental units and ensure its long-term stability. In South Carolina, I'm Caitlin Esch for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, file under celebrities, they're just like us. President Obama did his regular Super Bowl interview last night, in which he revealed, stop the presses, that the Wi-Fi in the family quarters at the White House stinks. Apparently it bugs his kids no end, Michelle Obama too. One does wonder, though, whether he couldn't just get a couple of White House communications agency people up there to, you know, fix it, right? What's the good of being president? Hope y'all were paying attention to the music today. Seriously. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 177 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ down 79 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 down 26 points, 1.4%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.